Hello, welcome to the 5280 podcast. Strap on and have a good time.
From the Mobile 5280 Studios, Weekend Geek Special Report. From the floor of Denver Comic-Con, Smurf here, along with this is a project that is very close to my heart. Being since, my heart is poured deeply into this. I have Russell Nolte, who has taken my baby, coddled it, nursed it, and brought it to life in what we like to call
Monsters and Other Scary Shit, an anthology about monsters.
Russell, thank you for sitting in. It's a pleasure to meet you face-to-face because all we've done is exchange emails and gone back and forth and all of that. So it's a pleasure to put a face with the name. What's it like being in Denver? I mean, you've done the con before, but you've got a pitch this year, right?
Well, I've never done this show before. Oh, I do okay. A lot of shows, but I'm actually a guest of Zach Skellington, your amazing artist, on the anthology piece that you guys did.
Yep.
He's been trying to get me out here for a couple of years, and finally I was like, all right, I now want to expand into more like west, further east than I've ever done before. And we did San Diego. We've done San Diego a couple of years, but we did Emerald City this year and Phoenix and San Jose and a couple of other cities that we've never been to before. So this felt like, since we had the anthology,
right,
which I thought I would get by now and have to sell at this show, but that's a different story. Denver is great. It reminds me of Seattle, which reminds me of San Diego, which reminds me of San Francisco and San Diego, which reminds me of D.C., which is my hometown that I love. So except for the massive rainstorm that we had that first night.
Oh, my God. I know. I woke up like, what the hell? The neighbors are fighting? No, it's like a monsoon hit, like a Gilligan Island storm and shit.
Is that normal?
No, not like that.
I'm from L.A., and the last two shows I did were Phoenix and
Emerald City.
And no, I did Las Vegas.
Oh.
And they don't have weather. So
no.
We don't really have weather, unless you consider massive heat enough to melt a car weather.
Yeah, you come out to melted tires and the car is non-existent at that point.
Exactly.
Now, what did you think of Emerald City? Because that is probably now, with the exception of C2E2, my favorite con right now.
It is phenomenal. I was there for the first time this year, and I do a lot of shows, and there's few that I would like buy a lifetime pass to if I could.
All right.
And that's one of them. It's definitely a top five show, not just for money, which is important to me because this is how I pay my mortgage.
Well, yeah, this is your living.
Right, but also for the fan interaction. So I don't judge the success of a show by how much I sell. I've sold a lot at a show that I've hated every minute of, and I've sold not that well at a show that I've loved. The best is when you love a show and you sell really well at it.
Yes.
But what I really judge a show by is the quality of the engagement with the people that are there, and whether they're interested in looking at independent comics, whether they're interested in the thing that I'm doing. This is one of those shows. Denver Comic Con and Emerald City is like Denver Comic Con on speed.
Yes.
So I really, really love it. And this year they separated the artist alley from the rest of the floor, which was basically everybody that was in that artist alley area was looking for artists for independent stuff. It was phenomenal.
And I like the way they did it because normally for Emerald City, they had the artists and everyone intermingled. And I mean, you took a corner and you had retailers, you had publishers, you had, you know, artists. It was a very interesting, you know, sandwich. So to have them break it up, I think was a very smart and good play. I enjoyed it.
It can be dangerous if you don't have enough people that are interested in independent artists.
It can sink it quick.
But when you have it and it's done right, it's a beautiful thing because you don't have people look at you cockeyed and be like, why would I even think about looking at an independent book? And you're like, dude, you're in Artist Alley. Like, this is the home of independent things. Like, don't look at me like I'm crazy for wanting you to look at a book. I look at you crazy
for not wanting to.
Like, you're walking down this aisle. Like, I'm not the one, like, pulling you from while you're looking at, like, the Pokemon booth.
Do you think... Now, this is because you're the second independent publisher. Do you think that this is where comics are going? Because, let's face it, our heroes are dying. I mean, Marvel and DC... love them for what they have done, but do you think the future is independent publishing? Is this what everybody wants?
So I think more and more, as people get disillusioned with DC and Marvel, more people are moving to independent comics. But I don't ever think independent comics wasn't a thing. I've always had success doing independent comics. The thing is all right, real talk.
Real talk, baby.
People that like Marvel and DC
will always like it.
Have been pulling teeth to get to look at independent comics.
Well, it has the stigma of, like, back in the day, if it wasn't a Marvel or DC book, you never looked at it. You're like, oh,
So this is a traditionally white male perspective. If you look at POC. Or females, they have never been represented in Marvel and DC comics, so they have always been interested in zines, in manga, and in independent stuff where there's better representation. So when I go to a manga or anime show, it's mostly POC and females who are coming up to my table, and they are willing, ready, and able to buy independent books.
Wow. So do you think it's just because people have opened their mind to it, or is it because the stories are what they want to read? Because Marvel's just a rehash. Same thing with DC.
Well, I think that it's a fact that a certain segment of the population has been represented in mainstream DC and Marvel comics, but most people have not been represented in those comics. So from the early 2000s, when they started importing manga, people were looking at manga as a way to find representation, to find stories that weren't so Marvel and DC as
so
they were
canned
by the numbers. And they started falling in love with creators and independent books. The same thing with zines. You know, when Marvel and DC didn't hire females, didn't hire POCs, they went and made their own zines. So there's amazing
I can't believe
zines.
How zines have taken off and how big that community is. I got introduced to it at Dink, which is another independent publishing con here last year, and I did some diving. Holy crap. It's like this thing just erupted overnight because they had no outlet.
Well, but it's been 20 years or more that they've been doing zines. The thing is that now people that like Raina Telemeyer, Hope Larson, Lisa Hannawalt, who does BoJack, who started doing her independent stuff and then got hired to do BoJack Horseman, and she does all of the character designs and basically is the art director for BoJack Horseman.
Right.
All of these people came from independent comics and doing their own independent zines. And so when people started saying, oh, look, Rachel Dukes, who's a friend of mine, does, oh, look, she does Steven Universe, and look, she does this book called she does Frankie's Comics.
Yep.
Wow.
That is a great book.
Yes, they're fantastic, and they go back and they say, well, where are these people? Where have they been all my life? And they say, oh, look, Spike Trotman's been doing books for 15, 20 years. They've just been all independent. And so... I really do think, and I am as guilty of this as anybody before I got into the comics, the independent scene, manga scene, and zine scene, being like, oh, people don't want independent comics. But it is truly, being a white heterosexual male and living in my own bubble, when I started breaking out of that and going to horror shows, going to zine shows, going to manga shows, going to book shows, and being, I also write a monopolist. So when I go to all of these other shows and see people who are not me, and they're like, well, duh, of course, zines have been this way for years and decades, and manga has been this way for decades, and there's this huge community of people who aren't white heterosexual males who have been getting their comics in this way because they've been underrepresented in mainstream comics for years.
Well, and like the underground scene when we were kids, I mean, that was like, oh, taboo. You know, you don't read the underground comics because they're not comic book code approved and all of that. And there's some great stuff out there that, you know, like Floop. I love that comic now after, you know, being told, no, it's underground, it's bad.
Right.
Well, now, when you were growing up, what were you reading? I mean, what were you pulled towards when you were younger?
I was reading X-Men and all of this stuff, and then I got disillusioned by all of that, by the story being the same over and over and over again. And look, I've read one weekend, I read about 10 back-to-back Batman stories, and I realized something. Every single one of them is exactly the same. Like, they're all exactly the same. And, like, I didn't know that there was this other scene going on, so I just abandoned it for, like, regular novels and books. And then when I found it again, my manager handed me a stack of comics one day, and I was like, ugh, I don't want to do comics. And I was like, I don't want to do, like, superheroes. And he's like, just read all of these, and then tell them you still don't want to do comics. And I read all of these amazing stuff from, like, The Devils Do Old Halloweens.
Yep.
And all of these independent stuff, and I was like, the hell has this been all my life? And he's like, it's always been here. You've just been blind to all of these other things. And so when I get involved in all of those stories was when I really realized that comics can be anything. And the audience
is out there.
Massive. The audience is massive. And here's the other thing. You don't need a massive audience to be successful. So look, our books are expensive. They're $30.
But they're worth it.
Hey, they're $30 for a book. I don't sell them really to bookstores. I mostly hand sell them or sell them on our site. So I retain almost all of that $30.
Mm-hmm.
But let's break that down. That $30 is 10 Marvel books.
Yeah.
So I have to sell a tenth of Marvel. Now, if Marvel's selling 10,000 of a book, I can sell 1,000 of that same book and make the same amount of money as Marvel does without any of the overhead.
Wow.
So you don't need a massive audience.
It puts it in perspective, doesn't it?
So here's the big thing is everything's global now. There's 7.8 billion people in this world, and you need about 10,000 buying your book to make a good living. I'm not saying a living, but like a good
survive.
Living.
Survive. You're doing well, and you can keep functioning.
Right. So, like, I mean, because you have all these operating costs. I peg it at about $200,000 a year, and then $100,000 of that goes back into costs. So you make $100,000 at the end of the year. You need about 10,000 people buying your book at $30.
Yeah.
So that's really not that much. That sounds like a huge amount, but in a world of 7.8 billion people, you're going to be rejected thousands
Small.
And hundreds of thousands of times, but you only need so many people in order to survive.
Yes.
And so, yes, do you have to be out there hustling? Yes, do you have to be on every podcast and, like, talking to every independent artist and being at every show to find people? Yeah. Do you have to sell? Do you have to do your pitch 1,000 times to find 100 people who are going to like it? Yeah. But that's part of the beast.
But, and that's where, because if you haven't guys figured out, Russell's very passionate. I mean, and I think that's where the passion comes from. I haven't seen that kind of passion in a lot of people. A lot of people are just thinking, well, I did this thing, but nobody's buying it. And they're not even pitching it. They're not out there working it. They just expect, well, I wrote it, and now they're supposed to come to me.
So this is the main point I've been trying to drive home for years, even before I got into comics, is we are a business.
Mm-hmm.
And if you are not willing to undertake the business side of this, then you are going to fail.
Yes.
Just like if you were a mechanic and all you want to do is sit in a shop all day without going out there and getting new business. Just like if you're an electrician and all you want to do is run wires all day, unless you are willing to go out and pound the pavement, you are not going to survive in any business. And, like, it's pretty arrogant to think that you are going to be able to do what you love 100% of the time.
Yeah.
Because no business can do that. Artists always say, I want to just do what I love. I don't want to do the business. I'm like, okay, that makes you equivalent to a mechanic or a plumber or an electrician or any other person. They're only able to do the thing they love 20% or less of the time.
You got to pay the bills.
Yeah. You got to be out there pounding the pavement or, you know, have another job. Have another job and do this on the side and be okay with 100 people reading your book.
Mm-hmm.
If that is all right, then
congratulations.
Right. But nobody is ever. People want to complain and then they don't want
to
do anything.
It's too easy to complain. Exactly.
So my philosophy is this. Either you do what you focus on this as a business and you grow it. And if that doesn't work, then you complain all day. Like, if you do what I tell you and it doesn't work at all, you can complain and bitch to me for the next 100 years.
Damn it, Russell!
But if you're not going to do anything to fix your situation, you can't bitch to me. I have literally zero empathy for you because I'm giving you a roadmap. The roadmap is out there. All you have to do is take it and utilize it. And frankly, I don't necessarily like being up at 5 in the morning to do podcasts. I don't like to write and then like spend most of my time like moderating Facebook groups and like putting together like Canva things and all of the other crap that I have to do to like balance budgets. I don't like that. I just want to write too. But you know what I want more? To not have a job.
Yeah.
And every day I wake up and go, oh my God, why am I doing this? I turn around and I look at the fact that the option behind me is get a job. And that chases me down to get up here at 5 in the morning to sleep in an uncomfortable bed, to be away from my wife for a week, and to sit here not like making a pitch 1,000 times to sell a book. To mostly unsuccessfully. So yeah, our books, we've sold out half of our books in the first day. But
wow, Jesus.
For every book that we, for every time I sold a book, there was 100 times that people looked at me funny and said, why are you even making this? This is crazy. But I don't care about that. What I care about is the person that's buying. They're the person that I'm making it
that's
for.
That's who it's for.
Exactly. And all of the other, look, Stephen King sells 2 million books, roughly. I know sometimes he sells 5 million or the numbers change. But he sells 2 million books out of a potential literate 2 billion people who could buy. What do you think he would do if he focused on those on the 1.8 billion people who never bought his book? He would be incapable of functioning if he focused on that 1.8 billion people. That's a ton of people.
It is.
But he doesn't. He focuses on the 2 million people that buy his book. And in doing that, he's able to make, I don't know, a lot of money.
An obscene amount of money.
An obscene amount of money. On what is admittedly a very small percent of the potential people that know who he exists.
Well, I don't even understand how Stephen King functions anymore because it's the same. Again, we're getting into the same story. He's resting on his laurels now at this point. It's all his stuff that he's written that is coming to fruition. Like the Dark Tower series, finally, after years of them working on that damn thing, is finally getting a movie.
Right, but that's how an author makes money. Mm-hmm. An author makes money on their backlist.
Yep.
So whenever someone says, why aren't I making money? I say, how many books have you put out? They say one. I've said, cool, put out 19 more books, 20 more books. And hopefully you can make $100 to $1,000 a month on each book.
Yep.
But if you're not, if you're like, if, then they go, ugh, that sounds like a lot of work. I'm like, it is a lot of work. You know what? It's way, way, way easier to go sit at a desk at a DMV and like take tickets all day. It is so much easier and cheaper. It is so easy. That is the easy path. And I recommend it for everybody, unless you physically can't do it. I am compulsed to do this. And most days I wake up going, oh my God, I got to get rejected 1,000 more times today.
How am I going to get snubbed today?
Right, it's all rejection. If I put out 100 interview requests, I'm going to get 10 back. 90 people are going to reject me. If I try and put an anthology together, this anthology that we're talking about, that Monsters and Other Scary Shit,
yeah.
I had about double that amount of people interested. I got 350 committed pages to get 220 pages actually completed.
Wow.
So even though that book is amazing, 130 pages didn't come in.
So walk me through the process, because I submitted with Zach after we did, because you asked for a synopsis, and I wrote up a quick synopsis based on what I've already written. Mm-hmm. And the whole story. So Zach submitted it to you, and at that point, thank you for accepting it.
So,
How many submissions did you get?
I don't remember the exact number, but 350 pages in the average submission. So about 35 to 40 submissions.
Okay.
We got, 41 submissions. I remember that now, to get 30 completed stories.
Holy crap.
And so let's just break this down even further.
Okay.
I had at the time, I've since culled about 2,500 Facebook friends. I had about 5,000 at the time. We've since increased to 8,000 people on our mailing lists, plus 30,000 Twitter followers, all of these people. So I had a lot of points of contact. Most of them are creators. Out of that, 41 people actually submitted to the anthology, which is a massive amount of rejection. Like, That's a fuck ton of rejection.
It is a fuck ton.
So imagine if I had said, oh my God, 35,000 people said no, they didn't want to be part of it. Like, I would be unable to function.
Wow.
But that 41 people that said yes for 350 pages, I pretty much, if I knew the artist, or if I've seen their work, if I knew they could deliver, I said yes to everybody. That's that was like, that either had a finished product, because a couple of them were finished.
Right.
And or I knew that they were going to deliver. So of those 41 people, 30 people got me actual pages. 220 committed pages.
See, and that just blows my mind. Here's an opportunity, and they're like, I don't have anything. And how do you not? That just frustrates the hell out of me.
It doesn't fluster me anymore. It does. These things don't fluster me. Maybe it wasn't the right time. There's 1,000 reasons. Maybe they already had a bunch of books to do. Maybe they didn't trust I was going to put together a good anthology. Maybe, like, they're not a huge fan of monsters. Like, there's all sorts of reasons why they had, but I chose to focus on the 40 people and eventually 30 people who returned me stories.
So you decided to focus on the horror side. Is there...
No, I focused on the monsters.
That's true. So why the monsters?
So it's real simple. My first book was about monsters. Mm-hmm. My second book was about monsters. They were both comics. I had 300 people who had bought our books. Who liked monsters. I asked thousands of people that were our fans what they liked. They said monsters. What do you want to see more of me for? What do you want to see more from? Monsters. What artists do you like? And we made sure to have a couple of those people that my fans really liked. And then I said, okay, cool. So you want to see me do a comic and then a comic in a year? You like monsters. You like Invader Zim. So I got Aaron Alexievich, who draws Invader Zim,
which
to do
is
the cover.
Amazing. The cover is absolutely stunning. I got to see it at the table, and I'm like, oh, I rubbed it on my junk, so it's mine now.
So I basically asked the people what they wanted and then gave it to them. Like, business is really stupid simple.
Yeah, it's like work and you get stuff done.
And more importantly, it's finding the people who... finding an audience, asking them what they want, and then giving that thing to them, and then building an audience more, and asking them what they want, and delivering that thing to them. And then knowing that if you deliver something that's different, because I've written a mystery novel and a sci-fi novel and fantasy, and I'm much more a novelist now than I am a graphic novelist.
Right.
Knowing that a lot of that audience isn't going to track with, like, your new stuff. But I'm doing a book. I'm finishing my Monster Hunter trilogy later this year, early next year.
Nice.
With a book called Pixie Dust, which is about a pixie monster hunter that's betrayed, murdered, sells her soul to the queen of the underworld, that comes back as a zombie to seek revenge on the people that killed her. Why do you think I did that? Well, not only did I want to write the story, but monster, 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 monster. There's a pretty good fucking chance that people are going to come back and buy that book again, and I'm going to be able to satiate that audience, because that is all I care about. All I really care about is making something my audience is going to like and hoping that I honor them.
And from the sounds like you're doing it, because if they're asking for your monsters and you give it to them, they're going to buy it.
Right, like people, we live in a consumerist culture.
Yes.
People want to buy stuff. So they might as well buy it from me. Right? They might as well buy it from me.
Yeah.
Like if they're going to buy anyway, you might as well spend your money with me because you know that you're going to get something that you love.
Mm-hmm.
And that is my whole goal.
Well, and you're not a faceless corporation. You know where the money is going instead of, you know, to spread out and the poor artists and the writers that do all the heavy lifting, basically.
Right.
And the publisher takes the right. chief amount of it.
So I'll give you one more analogy because I know I got to get back to my table.
You got to get back to your table.
So I think of my life and my whole my business as a funnel, a sales funnel. So people have to know, like, and trust me before they're willing to buy from me. Now, we all have that friend. So here's how I think of a funnel: know, like, trust, buy. So we all have that uncle who we know but don't like.
Right.
That cousin we like but don't trust. That friend that we trust, but damn it, he always brings like anchovy pizza and you like pepperoni. So, like, you're
fuck
not going
to
give him money. Like, you're not going to buy that. You're not going to give that guy $20 because he's just going to bring back the wrong effing pizza. Like, you just don't. You like him. You trust him. He's a great guy. But he's not. You and his tastes aren't aligned. Well, we also have that friend who, like, you will willingly give $20 to blindly because Like, he'll always bring back that cool thing.
Mm-hmm.
He'll always get the tickets
that
you want.
One little thing.
Right. He'll always get the tickets you like. He'll always get the move. He'll always get the pizza that you like. He'll always, if he says, we're going to do something cool, give me $50, you'll give it to him. And my goal is to find the people who will willingly, blindly give me that money because they know that I'm always going to bring them the right pizza.
Right. Here it is.
And then continue to deliver them the right pizza so that they continue to give me the money because they know that I'm always going to deliver something that's awesome.
It's a perpetual cycle. Go figure.
Right.
The horror anthology is going to be available through
Monster Anthology.
Monster Anthology. I keep saying horror anthology.
All right. So here's the thing. It's called Monsters and Other Scary Shit. It's monsters from cute to scary and everything in between. And it is because everyone, the real reason, the underlying issue is that everybody that I talk to thinks that I'm a horror publisher. Even though I've only published one horror book and almost everything else that I publish is fantasy, including
really?
Katrina Hates Dead Shit, which has a big zombie getting hacked on the cover. And I have to tell people, zombies have a long and storied mythological tradition far beyond, dating back far before horror ever was even a genre.
Mm-hmm.
Hundreds, thousands of years, like the Bible. Lazarus is a fucking zombie.
Yes, he is.
So
is Jesus, but...
So here's the thing, is people kept saying I was a horror publisher, and horror's, like, of all the genres, my least favorite. I love horror, but it's my least favorite.
Okay.
What I love are monsters. Mostly mythological monsters, but sci-fi monsters and all sorts of monsters. So I wanted to have an anthology to show people all of the wide-ranging things that monsters can elicit.
Right.
It can be in Lord of the Rings has monsters. Event Horizon has monsters.
Event Horizon's got a wicked monster.
Mm. Right? All sorts. You can have monsters in fantasy, sci-fi, in literary fiction. You can have monsters that are psychological, mythological. You can have monsters for any kind of monster that you want. You can have funny monsters, like in Monsters Incorporated. And I wanted to show all of the ways that monsters can be used so people would quit saying
horror.
That I was a horror publisher. Really, if you want to get, it was my, like, most of the best things in my life are fueled from bitterness. And the bitterness of being called a horror publisher for 10 years.
Just set you off, eh?
Yes, because monsters are amazing, and everything has monsters. Adventure Time has monsters.
Adventure Time has monsters.
So everything you watch has monsters.
Rick and Morty's got monsters.
Yep. Sometimes they are cute. Sometimes they are scary. Sometimes they are funny. Sometimes they are mythological. Sometimes they are psychological. But everything has monsters in it. And so I hope that this anthology, which we hope will be out in October, we're still waiting for the slow boat from China.
Mm.
But hopefully we're doing everything we can to make the best anthology, not the quickest one. So we now have approved the proof. We're waiting for it to print, and then we're waiting for it to ship. We're hoping that we get it in September or October, and then we'll have it on sale later this year for the holidays.
Sweet. What is the best way to follow you, Russell, if they want to keep up with the monsters as they march across the country?
Sure. If you want some free comics, you can go to wannabepress.com, sign up for our mailing list, you can get a free comic. My Instagram and Twitter are both at Russell Nolte. That's two S's, two L's, N-O-H-E-L-T-Y. I also have Instagram, which is also Russell Nolte. You can follow Wannabe Press, but I really don't check that much.
Right.
Also, I have a podcast called The Business of Art. We've done over 170 episodes, all about how to turn your art into a business. We interview creators like Dirk Manning, Jim Zub, Richard Starkings, who lettered Killing Joke and created Elephant Men. All sorts of creators for how they built and sustained their business over time. And I have a nonfiction book coming out later this year called Sell Your Soul, How to Build Your Creative Career in that vein.
Very nice. So in your mind, what is the best story you've ever read that is always your go-to that you're like, this is what I want to achieve. This is what I want to be.
That I read or wrote?
Read.
So... It's tough.
Because of course it is.
I think so. It's 1984. But
the book 1984?
The book 1984.
Which is a twisted story.
But if I have to read a book again and again, it's probably going to be Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy or Cat's Cradle. My three influences are Terry Pratchett, Kurt Vonnegut, and Douglas Adams. If they had a blasphemous love child somehow,
you would be it.
That would be me.
Wow. In fact, I'm just now getting into all the Discworld and all of that for Terry Pratchett. Watched all the series, which, thanks to Red, showed them to me. I didn't even know these shows existed. The Discworld shows are hilarious. They are great, and they build so well off of each other.
What I love about Terry Pratchett specifically is he's created this world where you can read any of his stories separately and have an enjoyable experience. But if you read multiple, you start seeing the interconnectivity.
Yes.
Which is something I've always respected about Stephen King, Christopher Moore, Terry Pratchett, and how I try and build. So my main universe is called the Shitiverse, which is all of our books kind of tie together. And while there's going to be a main trilogy, which is the Katrina Hates Dead Shit,
right.
Katrina Hates the Gods, Katrina Hates the Universe, which will be out next year, my goal is that you can read any of our stories separately, but if you read them together, you kind of get a better sense of the universe, which is something that I think Terry Pratchett does better than anybody else.
I can't think of anyone that does it better than Pratchett, because even as good as Douglas Adams was, Pratchett just the subtleties that are in the background.
I like Stephen King and Christopher Moore do this really well too, but. Mm-hmm. Terry Pratchett actually makes it known that this is how he operates. Whereas those two other authors I mentioned, they don't really they have a shared universe, but it's not real. It's very, very, very
vague.
Subtle.
Yeah, it's very
Whereas
vague.
Like Terry Pratchett is like, nope, it's all Discworld. It all happens on this world. So he makes it known, and that's why I think he does it better than anybody.
And he does, with it, that setup, he does take a lot of liberties with, like, when you think you know what he's doing, he'll throw you a curve. You're like, oh, well, shit, I didn't see that coming.
For sure.
Now, the final question I'll ask you, and then I'll let you get back to your table. The best villain, because monsters are not necessarily villains, but you need a protagonist. Who is the best villain? Tim Curry, Alan Rickman, Christopher Walken.
Tim Curry.
Right.
Without a doubt, he has the most range of his villains and the most entertaining villains who can also be very comedic. While Alan Rickman has great timing and can be comedic, he is often a very similar villain at each... Whereas Tim Curry can be a very dramatic villain,
yes.
But he has the most comedic whilst... He can be the most comedic while still being completely terrifying.
Extremely terrifying. Well, Russell, thank you so much for publishing me. Thank you so much for sitting in on the podcast. Look forward to more stuff from Russell. As the book comes out, we will be talking about it. It will be a link on our page. Check out Russell. It's never a dull time with this man. Thank you so much, Russell.
Well, and go to wannabepress.com if you want to see what we've already done and get a sense of the kind of stuff and the kind of quality that the Monster and Other Scary Shit Anthology is going to have.
Because in the end, we're all stories, so make it a good one.